chapter 2 of the book of Genesis leaves us with a view of paradise in which the first man and first woman coexisted in perfect harmony, had an unblemished relationship with the living God, enjoyed his continual presence and his absolute blessing upon their lives. They lived in perfection. They lived in harmony. And then in the beginning of chapter 3, we discover things changing markedly. The man and his wife, who had both been naked and were not ashamed, have their eyes opened, know that they are naked, and sew fig leaves together and make themselves loincloths. And in the midst of this activity then, as they try to cover their shame, to hide that which has displayed itself to them, not only physically in terms of their differences, but the pangs of conscience that have gone with their disobedience, they hear a sound. The sound is described as that of the Lord walking in the garden in the cool of the day, though the Hebrew is translated differently by different people and is quite difficult really to understand, but the general idea is very clear nevertheless. Something is heard that indicates God's presence. And Adam and Eve scurry into the undergrowth, like little children doing something wrong, who hears the approaching footsteps of their parents. They hide away. For here is a sad reality. That which had been made perfect has been spoiled. A relationship in which there had been uninhibited communion, perfect enjoyment, and unconcealed delight has been destroyed. The sad reality is that no longer can Adam and Eve bear the approach of God. They had enjoyed his presence up until this point. They had participated in conversation with their Creator and had had no pangs of conscience, no troubled minds. But in a moment, that has all changed. Their relationship with one another has been spoiled, but so too has their relationship with their Creator. This transcendent God, who powerfully, with a word, has brought the universe into being, who created the heavens and the earth by the word of his power, who separated light from darkness and water from land, who filled the heavens with the shining bodies of the sun and stars and moon, and filled the sky with the flying creatures and the seas with the swimming creatures and the land with the walking and crawling creatures, and who created the pinnacle of this universe in his own representative, mankind. All by the word of his power brought all of this into being. This God had revealed himself not only as the transcendent God, separate from all that he had made, distinct from it all, over it all, and supreme in it all, had also revealed himself as the relational God, who did not only create and sustain moment by moment the world that he had made, but interacted with it and spoke to it and revealed himself in it. He is presented to us in the first verses of this book as God, Elohim, the transcendent creator. But then from verse 4 of chapter 2 through to the end of chapter 3, he's presented to us as Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, using particularly that covenant name that would mark this God as the God of Israel in the future. Here he is presented as the relational God, the God of covenant, the God of promises, the God who interacts with his people. But there's a glaring exception to this rule in chapters 2 and 3. This God who relates to his creatures in verses 1 to 7 of chapter 3 is referred to simply as Elohim once again. The transcendent one, the one who is separate from this created order, the one who is distinct and, as it were, distant from it. Satan subtly comes and speaks to the woman and says, did God, did Elohim actually say to you, it's no longer Yahweh Elohim. We don't want a personal God within this temptation scene. And the woman responds in like manner. We may eat of the fruit trees, but Elohim, God, said you shall not eat of this particular tree. And so it goes on in that short section in the midst of all the rest. The covenant God is forgotten, and the distant God alone is brought to memory. And then in verse 8, it is the sound of Yahweh Elohim, of the Lord God, of the covenant God, the God of relationship, who is heard in the garden. And the conscience quivers. In contrast then to this uninhibited fellowship that previously had been enjoyed, their circumstances in verse 8 of chapter 3 are so very different from those at the end of chapter 2. The paradise that they had enjoyed in perfect innocence and total openness has completely vanished. And no longer can they bear to hear God. The man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of Yahweh Elohim among the trees of the garden. They couldn't face him. Not now. Not anymore. For they have made a significant discovery. The disobedience to him destroys fellowship with him. They no longer love the light, but they long for the darkness. To use the words of Jesus in John's Gospel, chapter 3, everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his deeds have been carried out in God. But you see, Adam and Eve, their deeds had not been carried out in God. They had forgotten God. They had rejected God. They had gone their own way. And they knew it. They couldn't face God. They couldn't risk what they had done being revealed. And so into the undergrowth they scurry. But we must note that God confronts them, though he does so gently. God calls man to account. Notice firstly, as he calls them to account, that it is Adam who is addressed by God. They hid themselves in the trees of the garden, and in verse 9, but the Lord God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" Adam is addressed by God. This is in stark contrast to the dialogue that has just passed between the serpent and the woman. There, the serpent said to the woman, did God actually say? Here, Adam is addressed by God, for it is Adam who had received the command that the woman was tempted to disobey. She had not yet been made. The command was given to the man whom God had made out of the dust of the earth and placed in the garden to work it and to guard it. You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. He received the command. He, therefore, is responsible for what has transpired. Furthermore, he, as the first and as the head, is responsible. Paul, writing in Timothy, makes this clear in 1 Timothy chapter 1. Chapter 2, and in verse 13, speaking about the proper order and relationship between men and women, we're told Adam was formed first and then Eve. Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. There's a particular order in creation, and there's a particular responsibility that entails from that order. And not only was Adam the personal recipient of the command from God, but he is also, by virtue of his creation, more responsible than Eve for what transpired. It is Adam who is addressed by God. The second thing we must note, as God calls man to account, is that Adam is invited, as it were, to come clean regarding what has transpired. The question is called out into the garden, "Where are you?" God knows where he is. God has not only heard the rustling of the undergrowth as Adam tries desperately to hide from the all-seeing, all-knowing God, but God has heard the words spoken, has seen the actions committed, has watched these two sewing fig leaves together and making themselves these ridiculous coverings. And he sees them shaking in the undergrowth. He knows where they are, but you see, here is an invitation to Adam. Come on, Adam. Tell me what happened. Here is an opportunity to come out from his hiding spot and be open about what has transpired. To be naked before God once again. In the third place, we see, as God calls man to account, that Adam is confronted with his guilt. Adam's response to the first question is somewhat evasive. "Where are you?" God says, and Presumably out comes Adam from his hiding place as he responds, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." He hasn't said anything about what happened. He's confessed fear, something that he had never had before. He's acknowledged his nakedness, despite the fact that he's attempted to make loincloths for himself. He knows it's not an adequate covering from the all-seeing, all-perceiving God. But his response is nevertheless evasive. There is no admission here of wrongdoing. And God asks him, "Who told you that you were naked?" And immediately follows it up with a second question, in which the Hebrew is constructed with an expected affirmative response. "Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" Or we could say something like, "Surely you have eaten of the tree that I commanded you not to eat." There is no other explanation for you knowing, perceiving your nakedness. Certainly not that it would have bothered you or caused you any shame. In the perfect innocence of paradise, their nakedness was neither here nor there. It mattered not. It was a physical symbol of the openness of their own hearts and consciences before one another and before God. But that has all been destroyed. And there's only one explanation for the destruction of this innocence. They must have eaten of the one tree that they were commanded not to eat. Yes, they had been commanded not to eat of it. It wasn't just a suggestion. It wasn't simply God saying, as the serpent had implied when he spoke to Eve. Did God actually say, "You shall not eat"? No, the Lord God commanded the man, saying, You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. Not just a suggestion, not just a comment, an afterthought, as he placed man in the garden of paradise that he had prepared for him to cultivate and represent him in this creation. No, this was a considered, deliberate command that was earnestly and carefully conveyed to Adam so that he would have absolutely no doubt whatsoever as to what was imposed upon him, the limitation that was presented to him. And God, and Adam's hiding of himself in the garden, and confession of his fear of God, an acknowledgement of his nakedness, could mean only one thing. Adam had disobeyed the clear command of God. And yet, in the midst of this, the reality is that there's another invitation, another opportunity for Adam to come clean. Another opportunity for Adam to be open and honest with God about what had happened, and if possible, to seek God's favour and mercy. God has called man to account. And how does man respond? Man responds with denial and blame shifting. "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat? You have been caught, Adam. The man said, the woman. The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree, and I ate. It's her fault, and it's your fault. If you had only done things differently, God, I wouldn't be in this predicament now. If you hadn't set me in this particular circumstance, in this particular place, with this particular person, this would never have happened. It's because you gave me this woman, and she gave me the fruit of the tree. That's why this has come about. I am not to blame. You see, sin brings with it an unwillingness to admit guilt. Furthermore, we see the way that not only has the innocence of Adam been destroyed, but relationships are getting worse and worse and worse. The eyes of them both were open. They see their nakedness. They're ashamed to be in each other's presence now, and so they must cover themselves. They need to hide away from God because they're ashamed and fearful to come into His presence. Sin is destroying these relationships, but it gets worse and worse. Now Adam, foolishly, inexplicably points the finger at God as well as this woman. He's making his matters worse for himself in both aspects. I mean, think about it. He's got another 930 years to live with this woman. And he's putting all the blame on her. I'm sure she made life miserable for him. Marital bliss ended when that fruit was eaten. He perhaps was showing his solidarity with her as he took the fruit from her hand and bit into it. But it actually destroyed their relationship. And it destroyed his relationship with his God as well. Not content to blame the woman, he blames God. He implies that it's all God's fault. Blame shifting is seen in the woman's response as well. God turns to the woman. What is this that you have done? And the woman said, the serpent deceived me, and I ate. And so this has become a mark of humanity since that day. We see it in our own children. They don't learn to blame someone else, something else, anyone else but themselves. It's ingrained in their very nature. Since Adam and Eve's fall in the Garden of Eden, man responds to God's call to give account with denial and blame shifting. What will you say when God confronts you in your sin? I don't just mean at the end of the age when God will sit on his judgment throne and call you to give an account. He does that over and over and over and over again with opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to come clean about your sinfulness about your failure to keep his commands and to do his will. But what do then? Do you follow Adam's example and shift the blame onto someone else? Do you even try to point the finger at God? James spoke of this issue when in James chapter 1 and verse 13 he says, "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am being tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one, but each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." It is our own desires, the desires of our own hearts, that lead us into sin. The point is, when that happens, what do we do? When it happened to Adam, he blamed the woman and he blamed God. When it happens to you, what do you do? Do you blame it on your upbringing? Do you blame it on your circumstances? Do you blame it on peer pressure? Do you blame it on the makeup of your personality? All of this is sidestepping the real issue. The root cause of any sin in your life is your own desire at that particular moment in time was stronger to sin than to do anything else. The point is, what will you do with your guilt? Will you try to hide it away like Adam and Eve did, or will you confess it? God has provided the answer for our guilt. If we confess it, he will shift the blame to his own son. We don't need to be fearful of God if we trust in Jesus, despite our failings, despite our yielding to temptation over and over and over again. Not that this is a license to sin. No, out of gratitude for what Jesus has done for us, we ought to strain every nerve in order to resist temptation and avoid sin. But the point is this, we don't need to hide ourselves away in some vain hope that God will not search us out and find us. Rather, we should come out into the open and come clean with regard to our sin, and God will transfer all the blame onto his Son and deal with it there, cleansing us from our guilt, purging us from our unrighteousness, and restoring the intimacy of relationship with him and the innocence that we can enjoy with him. When God confronts you in the midst of your life, when God calls you to account, what will you do?